Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, more of a conversation about coronavirus because it simply will not go away. We saw increasing cases, increasing hospitalizations. California has now topped over a million cases. Are we going to see more lockdowns, more restrictions? We talk with Dr. Mehmet Oz, host of The Dr. Oz Show. And then a conversation about President Trump's headspace right now. What's he doing? Why isn't he conceding? Where do we go from here? We're joined by Anthony Scaramucci, the former White House communications director, who is now not a big fan of Donald Trump, and Rick Gates, the former deputy campaign manager for President Trump, who is still a big fan of President Trump. That conversation in a moment, but we begin with Dr. Oz and a conversation about coronavirus, and we start by talking about some good news when it comes to vaccines.
Dr. Oz, welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you, Alex.
Let's talk about this vaccine. We hear reports this week of a vaccine from Pfizer that's 90% effective. How big a deal is that, and when can we get it?
It's about as big a deal as you could imagine. Every single expert I've had on my show, folks from the White House Task Force, everybody said the vaccine might work at, you know, 50, 60%. 50% was a cutoff for allowing it to be used in Americans. The fact that it's working at 90% is stunning to all of us. And there's two reasons it's important. First, it's a big bright light at the end of this dark tunnel we're in, as you pointed out with that Godfather scene. It just never seems to end. Now we know there's going to be a finish line, and we know about when that's going to be, too. And it also, really importantly, Alex, highlights the fact that the theory behind these vaccines actually works. There was the possibility that making antibodies against the spike protein of the coronavirus wouldn't really matter. It wouldn't protect us. And it, although it theoretically might, and everyone was praying it would, we didn't know that until this 44,000 patient trial that Pfizer put together, together with a company in Germany, by the way, which is important because the actual discovery, just to give you an idea of the of how important these scientists are, was made by a husband-wife Turkish team. It wasn't a bunch of multinational conglomerates. It was two people married to each other, working together, that came up with the vaccine concept. Wow. And that's what's going to, I hope, shine a beautiful, nice light on next spring.
Okay, so you say next spring, and we know that healthcare workers are going to get this first. I mean, what does this rollout look like? Because the government, President Trump's talked a lot about this, Operation Warp Speed, has invested a lot of money to try to make this process go faster.
So this vaccine development just for Pfizer cost $2 billion. The government is paying Pfizer $2 billion to get enough vaccines to take care of starting off 25 million people, hopefully by January. Those will again be healthcare workers because you want them to stay healthy. And you also want to make sure people in nursing homes, the vulnerable members of society where we're getting most of our deaths, are protected. And this vaccine does seem to work in older people. And that's also good news, which we weren't sure was going to be true. After that, it'll slowly roll out to the rest of the country, to me, you, and everybody else who doesn't have to get it first. We'll wait in line and get our vaccine. I'm hoping that by next, you know, by the time the weather gets warm again in this part of the country, New York, we'll have enough vaccine for most people to get the shot 28 days apart. You know, got to get it, you know, a month apart from each other. And both their shots are important. But that means that we could get hundreds of millions of doses out by the middle of next year. So we can immunize a lot of Americans and go outside this country as well, if people desire.
In the meantime, though, that's still a long ways away. Let's talk for a moment about masks, because there's a lot of people that still don't want to wear masks. We got some new studies that show how important they are. Let's show you some video now. A UCLA study out this week showed that masks reduce the risk of respiratory droplet spreading by 77%. The combo of a face shield and a mask reduced the risk by 89%. What about those face shields, though, on their own? You know, some treat them like a replacement for masks. They just wear the face shield without the mask. If you don't wear the mask under the face shield, that slows spread by only 4%. So it's not nothing, but it's certainly not anywhere close to wearing the mask itself. But yet, Dr. Oz, there's still so many people that refuse to wear the mask. What do you say to those people? Why do you think this message is not getting through?
You know, I think we politicized it, obviously, but we also made it an issue of ego and, you know, and insulting people for being too dumb to wear a mask. That's not going to work. Think of it this way. If you're going for heart surgery, which is what I do, would you want your doctor coming into the room to, you know, scrub without a mask on? No. You'd say, put the mask on. Why? Because it probably helps. In fact, it does help. But even if you weren't sure, you'd still put the mask on to be as careful as you could. Masks give us freedom. The reason that masks are a wise move is not just because it's loving and kind and people are telling you to do it and you're hearing all kinds of, you know, testimonials. It's because it's the way that you can gain your freedom back, because nobody wants to spend 6 months with the kinds of case spikes that we're witnessing right now. Now, the face shields, since you bring it up, I'm not a huge proponent of them. I do think glasses or goggles might be helpful. That's probably most of the benefit. But wearing a face shield without the mask, you're making an effort without a huge return.
Meanwhile, let's talk for a moment about travel. At the end of this week, California, other Western states advising that you quarantine after traveling out of state for 2 weeks. They say this isn't a requirement, it's just a recommendation. Does this recommendation make sense? And should it be a requirement? Because in your state, New York, they have done more restrictive requirements.
It's been a law here for months and months. I mean, I haven't been able to leave this area, I don't think, since the middle of the summer, because I can't come back and I have to be quarantined for 2 weeks. I can't even go to my studio. And so it is draconian. I do think it makes sense when you have one part of the country where there's no cases or very few and the other part where there's a lot of cases. So in the beginning of this whole pandemic, I could have imagined quarantining this area, New York, and not letting us travel out. But that's historically what a quarantine was. You quarantined the sick people inside of a small space so they couldn't contaminate the healthy people. Now, for some reason, we have flipped it on its head. We're quarantining the healthy people in order to keep them away from the sick people. It's to me, a bit more of a challenge in the current environment because the virus is everywhere. And I know that because I've been to the sewage treatment facility here in New York. People have done that in Los Angeles as well. We're realizing more and more that, because it comes out of our stool, comes out of all of our orifices, that the virus is everywhere. There's community spread. Mm. So I don't know how much of a benefit it is to prevent Californians from traveling to Utah, where there's a lot more cases. Theoretically, of some value, I understand why it's happening, but we're slowly losing the merits of that. And here in New York, we've changed the rule now. Now the rule is, because no one could come to New York, no one could leave New York, because everybody had more cases than us. Now the rule is you got to get tested before you come and then after you've come. And if you do that within a couple days, then you can go to work again.
Thank you for that visual of coming out of your stool. That was really, really nice to think about. Let's talk.
Just for you, Alex.
Thank you. Let's talk for a moment about Thanksgiving, because part of the reason a lot of people are planning to travel right now is to see their family for Thanksgiving. There's a recommendation of, you know, maybe having very small gatherings. What's a safe way to do Thanksgiving? Because this means so much to people emotionally, Thanksgiving.
Yeah, we've got a battered psyche in America, and I think enjoying Thanksgiving is important and is probably inevitable at this point. But here's the metaphor. Cigarette smokers. If you saw someone smoking, you had a big plume of smoke coming out of their mouth after they exhaled. You want to stay away from that plume. So what works? Well, being outdoors works, right? You smoke cigarettes outside. In most parts of the world, you can't even smoke inside. And so I would use those tactics. So the virus spreads 20 times more commonly indoors than outdoors. So if you can have Thanksgiving outside, big move forward. But here's the main message. Respect the virus. If you treat it wisely, for example, keeping the tribe that gets together for Thanksgiving a little smaller, maybe 10 people. If the people who come are practicing the same precautions that you are, which you got to start right now to reduce the chance that you might show up asymptomatically infected. If you keep the people who are vulnerable, grandma doesn't come to the table and sit with everybody else because you don't want her getting sick. You don't want to worry about it for the week after Thanksgiving. But the kids, yeah, let them play outside because they're probably going to be okay. And these are the kinds of moves that I think will make most Americans satisfied. You bring up travel. Traveling is a problem because you're going to be moving from some hot spots to other hot spots. But it's not the actual airplane, for example, that's the worry, because we've got data showing that the spread is trivial on an airplane. It's getting to the airplane that's the problem. It's getting into a rideshare, not keeping the window cracked so you get fresh air ventilating through. It's taking the risk of sitting with people you love dearly in a poorly ventilated space and then a week later finding out that 10 of you got sick.
Well, let's talk. Speaking of Thanksgiving, you know, during quarantine, you've gotten to spend a lot of time with your family. They've helped on every aspect of your show. Can you reflect for a moment on what your family has meant to you, how they've changed your mindset being surrounded by them?
Well, those are the daughters there. We've got four kids, four grandkids. And I learned a lot during quarantine, I think we all did, about the value of young energy, having children running around who are still a little naive to this COVID and the world around us, but they bring the life joy to us. I tell you, it would be hard for me to get through this without all of them around. I know that my in-laws really suffered because they were quarantined away from everybody because they're older, and it hurt them in a very big way. It took a while for that to come back, and I don't want it to happen again. But most fundamentally, we reset the system we had, which I think is valuable. You know those Etch-a-Sketch games some of us grew up with? You know, the little red-bordered game? It's as though you shook that, and all of a sudden you had a blank plate, a blank canvas on which to make a new world come true, and I think it's going to happen after 2020.
All right, and we end with our little game called Personal Issues. This is where we get to know you a little bit better with some rapid-fire questions. You ready?
Take it away.
All right. Favorite athlete?
Oh, gosh. It's Jim Brown, but that goes way back because he played for the Cleveland Browns.
Throwback. Favorite meal?
I love German chocolate cake. It's my big vice.
Favorite movie?
Actually, I love The Godfather, but I'm going to put Matrix just ahead of it.
Okay. First concert you went to?
I went to a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert that blew my socks off. It's why I still love Freebird.
And lastly, who's your role model?
Alex Michelson.
Oh.
You know, actually, you know, I do admire you, actually. I could have said Dr. Drew, too. But the woman, the person I admire really is Oprah. She gave me my start in this business. But the reason I love her is not just because she's a great mentor, is because I see what she's like behind the scene. And she knows her values and she follows them. And that is hard to do because you got to tell the truth to show up in your life. And most of us struggle with that.
Our thanks to Dr. Oz. Now to Anthony Scaramucci, the former White House communications director who now hosts a podcast called Mooch FM. And Rick Gates, the former deputy campaign director for Trump 2016, who wrote a book called Wicked Games. Here they are talking about a big week in politics. Welcome to you both. I think it's interesting to have two people with insight into President Trump's mindset right now and people with different views of that. But Anthony, let's begin with you, because you've been on our show consistently pushing pretty hard for Joe Biden to get elected, at least after you broke with President Trump. What went through your mind when you saw President-elect Biden on stage?
Well, I was thinking probably not as happy as Melania, but I got to be in the top five in the country. I mean, that was my reaction to the whole thing. So, you know, look, I mean, I don't know. I think it's great, great for the country. We'll get back to normal. It's predictable what the president's doing now in terms of not conceding. It's a bunch of nonsense. But I guess I'm a little sore at the GOP that they're allowing him to do this sort of stuff. It's not going to reflect well on us. When things return back to normal and the anger dissipates and all this tribal nonsense ends and we get back to some good policies, people are going to be like, why were we doing that? And I think these sorts of people, these acolytes and sycophants, are going to get punished.
Rick, your reaction when you saw Joe Biden on stage?
Sure. You know, look, thanks for having me, and it's good to be with you. For Donald Trump and for the campaign, this election is not over. He's not going to concede at this stage. As Anthony pointed out, you know, the president's a fighter. He's always fought. He fought in 2016 to win, and he's going to continue fighting. But it opens up a whole, you know, set of issues I'm sure we'll get into in terms of what the president's next steps are, what he has remaining. Obviously, some of the doors have closed. So there's a lot more to, you know, kind of peel back. But look, I mean, at the end of the day, this is a democratic process. I mean, the most, you know, exciting thing about this is we're watching the process unfold. I think Americans are learning a lot about how our Constitution works, how elections work. And so, you know, look, we have a calendar of defined times. We've got time. You know, everybody should be patient. Let all the votes count. Let's get it all in, and then we can decide. And then I think, you know, president will make some decisions, you know, down the road.
Rick, isn't there a difference, though, between saying, let's hear all of the votes, let the voters decide, let's count everything, and there has been voter fraud? What's the evidence of the voter fraud?
Well, honestly, right now, yeah, it's very minimal. This is a kind of time to either put up or shut up. And they've got to get the fraud. I mean, that is really the legal prong of the strategy right now is where they are. A lot of the lawsuits have been dismissed. I think this is probably a condition of not having that legal team, that legal piece in place to really, you know, define what that fraud was. Clearly, there is election fraud in every election. It's been like that for decades. We just never really cared or never put any time into fixing it as Americans because it's never significantly impacted a race. This race is extremely close. We got at least two recounts, maybe more, and that's going to be a big issue of why people are trying to identify this fraud.
Mooch, what do you think's going on in President Trump's head right now? Obviously, you can't answer that specifically, but you've spent a lot of time with him behind the scenes and know the way that he thinks. What do you think he's thinking?
Well, he doesn't like losing, and so I think that's part of the thing that Rick is getting to. That's why he's sort of manifesting this reality distortion that perhaps he can figure out a way to flip the election. And also, I think that he thinks that this is showing some strength to his base, the people that voted for him. But I would just point out that we have more people inside the White House that have COVID-19 than we have found people that have voted fraudulently. So it should be something he is thinking about, but I doubt that he's thinking about that. So we'll see. I thought he's particularly nasty this afternoon with the press conference and somewhat vindictive the way he was talking about New York and Governor Cuomo. And I think that every day that goes by, Alex, is another day of emphasis and evidence as to why the American people voted him out of office. This sort of nonsense and sore loser behavior is very un-American.
Rick, do you think that the president thinks that he won?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at it and you understand his mindset, he absolutely believes that there was fraud and illegal voting in this. Some of the election officials in some of the states have indicated that. But again, in the way that we've always viewed elections in this country, we've got to look at it, is it having that significant impact? I mean, some of the vote totals in some of these states are, you know, pretty significant. Can the president overturn them? Probably not, you know, in a lot of these cases. So we're going to have to wait and see when the official counts were. And again, this is why we have that, you know, calendar. This is why we have that process. The states still have to certify the votes. So again, we're unfolding that democratic process. Let it unfold. Once we get the final vote counts, the numbers are the numbers. You know, they're not going to lie at the end of the day.
Do you think the president won, Rick?
I think he did to a large extent. I think that there are issues with the mail-in ballots that need to be further investigated. I think the president's biggest opponent right now is not Joe Biden. It's Father Time. It's the clock. He's running out of opportunities to show where the fraud existed. However, with that said, we know that there are cases, again, where, you know, people that have not living in states have voted in jurisdictions where they shouldn't have. Again, is it significant enough? Probably not, but at least it shines a spotlight. And if anything comes out of this, Alex, I think it's a great opportunity for us to fix the electoral process in this country. It's given more awareness that voters can see how this process works and what's wrong with it.
Mooch, what do you think of that response from your old friend Rick?
Look, I like Rick. I'm glad that Rick is doing well and he's on his feet. I'm going to now go out and buy your book, Rick. I'm interested in reading it. But I think Rick's wrong. I think that there's minuscule fraud. They haven't been able to prove any. They've had very little standing in any of these courts. Most of these cases have been dismissed. He's 0 for 14 right now, if you look at the cases. And so he's got two things, the Father Time issue that Rick is bringing up, but he also had Mother Nature. Mother Nature came in here and gave him something that he really couldn't handle. You can't lie about the science, politicize the mask. You can't do the things that Dr. Oz was suggesting. And so we're in a rough state in the country right now. And it's unfortunate that he's not handling himself the way we would expect our presidents to handle themselves after they lose an election. And I just want to point out to everybody how badly he lost. Five states flipped. And in addition to that, he's the third president since World War II that's been ousted from the presidency, which is a sign of how terrible his term was.
And of course, Joe Biden got more votes than any other person who has ever run for president, and winning that electoral college, 5, 6, potentially 7 million votes, depending on how everything wraps up. So
Alex, he's got 306 electoral votes. And so just so you know, Trump said that that was a landslide last time. So that by the president's definition, Joe Biden has a landslide victory here.
So both of you guys have been in the room where it happens when some of this strategy is decided. So the GOP now has a big question. The people that aren't the president, the members of Congress, the senators, where do they go from here? right now, most of them have been backing President Trump in his arguments. Mooch, let me start with you. Where do you see the future of the GOP in a potential post-Trump world?
Well, they're making the bet that being his sycophant right now and being his acolyte is going to serve them well if there's some Trump cult-like transferability to them. But I think they're going to be sorely mistaken on that, because what's happened with Mr. Trump is a personality cult. And as he leaves the stage, that cult will dematerialize. People are talking about him running for re-election in 2024. I see that as a near impossibility. He was humiliated this time. He's not going to subject himself to that level of humiliation again. And I will say one thing about Mr. Trump. He's a great unifying figure. He's unified a very large part of the nation. He just happens to be unifying them against him. And so same thing would happen again next time. So I think they're just pacifying him right now.
But Mucci's also brought out, he also brought out, you know, more than 70 million people that were supporting him. I know you've talked about how terrible his policies are, but there's a huge number of Americans that really believe in him and believe in his message.
Maybe, or that could be a vote for them. You know, I grew up in a blue-collar family. I think that's more of a message about dissatisfaction with the system. When you really do the crosstab exit polling, they're voting against the establishment. Mr. Trump does represent that. The president represents that. But I don't think that they're necessarily voting for wrecking the economy by mishandling the pandemic and currying favor with despots and denigrating democratic leaders of the West. I don't think they're voting for that. And so I think that they're voting for, hey, this system is not working for me. I feel economically desperate, and I'm trying to send a message to people that you have to fix the system. And hopefully the vice president, now the president-elect's gotten that message. And if they can come up with the right policies, Alex, that anger will dissipate and Mr. Trump will be on the dustbin of history.
Isn't it extraordinary that he was able to be anti-establishment and be the president at the same time, which was some incredible jujitsu done by the Trump campaign on that. Rick, to you, do you see the president running again in 2024? Is there a path there? And where do you see Republicans going from here?
Sure, yeah. I think one of two things is going to happen. Either Donald Trump's going to come out and declare his second administration, or he's going to, if he doesn't prevail, he's going to immediately announce that he's running for 2024. Whether he actually does in the end, we'll see. But at least now, this is his Republican Party. There's no question about it. You look at the number of people that did vote for him, as you say, it's actually over 73 million people. And, you know, when you have that type of intensity, that type of base, about 75% of Republicans, they just did a poll on this, are saying that, you know, they don't believe the election was free and fair. Whether, again, it proves out to be true or not, that's a pretty powerful statement, and that shows the way that he's been able to kind of mold that base, and that base kind of adheres to, you know, his message and his rhetoric. And so I think moving forward, he's going to have a great command over that. And I think it'll be, you know, over time, as I always say, you know, one day in politics is an eternity, so anything can happen. But it's going to be very interesting to watch. But he is going to command that, because if he is knocked off the presidency, then he's going to want to jump right back in and make sure that he kind of can, you know, commands that that presence. You know, and I'll say one thing. I know Anthony, hopefully he'll agree with me, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I think Anthony personally has probably done better under President Trump's tax policies than he will under Joe Biden. So maybe, you know, he'll reconsider, you know, that down the road.
Mooch, your response?
Well, maybe. You know, listen, I first of all, if Joe Biden raises taxes, then Rick will be correct. But just go back to the Obama administration, 2009, 10, and 11. They talked about raising taxes, but it was an impossibility because of the weakness in the economy. So I don't see the tax cuts, the tax hikes going in. But Rick will be right. It'll be painful economically. But I will say this, we're racking up huge deficits. Someone's going to have to pay for them. And one thing about me, I have never complained about paying taxes in a country that I love.
And lastly, Mooch, to you, you're such a media mastermind as well. The president is as well. What do you see as his play now? Where does he go from here? Because we know that he's not going to want to step back and have no attention. So what do you see as next for him?
Well, I just want to point out, I don't know if I'm that big of a media mastermind. I only lasted one Mooch in the White House. Mr. Trump lasted 132.78 mooches, so he's more of a media mastermind than me. But I think his play is a subscription service, something similar to Glenn Beck. I think he's got the following for that. I don't think he's going to get carriage on these, for quote unquote Trump television, but he may team up with a Newsmax or an OAN that already has that carriage. I think that's more sensible. But I see him on a subscription service or streaming service, making oodles of money for himself and his family. And listen, nothing personal against him. He just wasn't fit to be the president of the United States. If he goes on to make money, that's America. God bless. But hopefully he'll pay more taxes than the $750 that he's paid the last few times that he's filed.
And real quickly to each of you, who wins the Georgia Senate race? At the end of the day, is it going to be a Democratic or Republican Senate? Mooch.
Well, I think the Republicans are going to win because it's lower turnout as a result of the fact that it's a runoff. And I think that they're better organized. It'll be close. Maybe one of the Democrats could win, but I think both of those seats will likely stay in the hands of the Republicans. And I say that objectively, not with any political bias.
And Rick, agree with that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the race is going to be much closer than it normally would, even in an off election year. The runoff, though, I mean, it's going to be the highest, invested race. You're going to have people from all over the country descending upon Georgia because the stakes are very high. But I agree with Anthony. I think you're going to have two Republican, senators elected from Georgia.
All right. Well, thank you both for sharing your views. Very interesting and a great conversation.
Our thanks to Rick and to Anthony and to Dr. Oz and to you for listening. I encourage you to connect with me in social media at Alex Michelson. Love to hear your thoughts. And love for you to listen the next time we bring you The Issue Is. Thanks so much.